Welcome to another episode of The Corporate Critic. We are here with Seneca Smith, our journalist, to have a conversation today about what local authorities do and how they structure themselves as a part of the government. We'll be looking at where powers are derived and how the local authorities are required to enter contracts and how they are required to govern themselves in order to govern the public, in order to have relationships with the public. So what we're going to do is start off just giving you a little bit of examples or a few examples of what it looks like in the law. And then we're going to have a discussion about some real life, real world applications of what civil rights violations look like, and also what it looks like for a person to sort of assert an administrative level of enforcement on civil rights and kind of different venues that we do as members of the public to hold corporations accountable when they are in the business of governing the public. So first, I'm going to just start off by talking about a couple of the resources that we're going to go to. We have a excerpt from the American Political Science Review, which is a social political science association. They have a resource that you can actually download just by Googling the name of it. It's called Public Agencies and Private Agencies by JSTOR. You can find it on the JSTOR website. And this document that we're going to look at just a little bit highlights the difference between a public agency and a private agency and what those things administratively allow corporations to do as local authorities in any state. And this includes your state courts, any municipality, and also the police departments, of course, the ones that are connected to those courts and, the state organizations. So when we have an understanding of what it means to have a private agency or a public agency, it allows us a lot easier to make determinations where the administrative enforcement should be occurring and also where we should be seeking remedy for damages and things of that nature. So I'm going to allow Mr. Smith to ask a few questions along the way, and we're going to basically take on an interview type of structure so this conversation can be informative for our listeners. So, Mr. Smith, please feel free to do anything if you did you want to introduce yourself and let us know who you are, what kind of experience you have, and what brings you here with Surf Inc. today.
Absolutely not. We're just going to roll with it. No. Eight introductions.
It's okay.
So I've worn too many hats in my life, too many hats. And so it's, people, especially when we're talking about sovereignty, to me, sovereignty is synonymous with responsible freedom. Mm-hmm. What I mean specifically by that is my ability to be as free to allow you to be free and vice versa.
Agreed.
I don't like the boxes, especially the boxes that have come out of colonization. Yeah, for the sake of all the beautiful people that's listening, my birth name is Seneca Smith. I'm named after my people, the Seneca. And you can look them up and you can look up what we've gone through in this history of being here on this continent. From Jersey, born and raised, home of the Brave, United States Marine, Hayne University alumni, father first, responsible citizen, warrior.
Very much. I know, so Mr. Smith did bring us quite a few resources to be able to help us to move through, just connecting with people that are in this space of administrative enforcement, people interested in government accountability. So we have quite a few opportunities that have been born of this connection. And so it's extremely refreshing to know that there are people who are very passionate about government accountability, especially when we break it down to the sense of corporate accountability. Because essentially, our entire government is run by an executive corporation where they are making executive orders, executive decisions that are governing our lifestyle and the things that we are have the so-called right to do or the privilege to do. So we want to break down some of those things and make sure that it's understood how these things impact our reality. So maybe we should start off by talking about Victor Hill first. So we had a brief kind of preface to this interview where we were talking about some of the things that happened with Victor Hill. So, you know, one thing I'd like to highlight about what happened in that case here in Clayton County, Georgia, Victor Hill was at work doing what everybody thought was his public duty under public trust, which is a public office. And so him taking the space of being in the sheriff's office, I know most of, you know, members of the public assume that there was some bureaucracy there, that there was some, you know, influences and powers that actually wanted Victor Hill not to be in his office anymore. Because in most situations, if you have a person that's in office, they're protected by their office whenever they're taking action or not taking action. In Victor Hill's case, he couldn't overcome the charges against him because of the action or the failure to act. So if anybody is unfamiliar with the case, this man was the sheriff of Clayton County, Georgia, and he ended up doing what I think they sentenced him to 18 months in prison recently because he was found to be violating the civil rights of inmates who were not convicted of anything. And he used a controversial form of restraint, which is called a restraint chair, where he had them strapped down into the chair because they were, according to him, being unruly or, you know, uncontrollable, whatever he deemed them to be. So in this situation, those people came and they became claimants against him. And the attorney general's office did eventually have the opportunity to convict him for that 18 months. So the overall message that I wanted to convey with that example is what happens when we are in at work, public office, that there is a corporate veil that allows us protection if we are in, you know, if we're functioning in a public office. But in his case, that corporate veil was pierced because the corporate coverage or the corporate sovereignty, so to speak, it only covers who is acting within their duties, within the provisions of their duties or within the scope of their authority. The second you step outside of that, you become unprotected or sort of uncovered by what they call state tort liability coverage, where the state pays for things that public officers do if they were committing or creating damages out of the functions of their office. So it's important to note here that Victor Hill is just like a lot of other public officers, where they're creating damages by, I want to say, a lack of thinking about what the scope of authority actually is. So, excuse me.
Did you say lack of training?
Yes, a lack of training on what the scope of authority is and what enforcement ability, what enforcement powers that office actually carries. So I would like to talk a little bit about that and see where we can take the conversation so that listeners can sort of gain a true understanding of where corporate authority comes from and what it has to do with members of the public, because they're required, so to speak, to have these commercial relationships in places where they are interacting. Like, it's not just a sovereign power over everything. That's not how it works. And we need to make sure that we don't have that perception, because it's dangerous to perceive it that way.
What do you think in Victor Hill's training specifically was lacking that had him feel, or I want to say empower him, to be able to do the things that he did? I mean, he had four separate cases. Mm-hmm. And if you do the research, they were all fairly around the same time. And I'll be honest with you, I truly, truly believe, and this is based upon empirical as well as anecdotal data. I've lived in Atlanta. I lived in Atlanta during the time he was elected. Mm-hmm. He went through all the stuff with Kimbrough. shooting the lady, all of those things. Like I was there in real time, and I felt like he was a significant problem. And in my mind, because it's the South, one of my degrees is in history, emphasis Africana studies. So I am highly versed on Jim Crow and everything associated with the repression and oppression of our peoples here on this continent. So with him in particular, I'm like, at the time, I'm like, it must be just because it's the South that he's allowed to be the way he is. He's the overseer. You know what I mean? He's the gatekeeper for their ways. He's the buffer. Yet, and I was very surprised when he was indicted. Wasn't surprised when he beat the case the first time in 12. Surprised when they indicted him again. Even more surprised when they actually convicted him. And so what in your mind, because you said you believe it's because of a lack of training. And I'm like, that's an interesting way to put it. Because when lack of training, one can infer that somehow they weren't trained to do a certain thing or to prevent a certain thing. However, if you look at these violations, we're talking about humanity. We're talking about just what's right, just as a species. So what in your thought process was lacking in his training? Like they didn't train him how to be a human? Like what, I don't, you know, what would you say regarding that question?
In a very general sense, the training lacks with constitutional law and also international law. Being trained in what a person says, like you said, comes from international law. It comes from superseding laws. And so the fact that those provisions of law are omitted from consideration in any state level government is going to be highly problematic for enforcement purposes, because if a person does not exercise their, or I should say, if they do not express their international rights within any state government, especially deriving from a state constitution, the United States does not recognize those international rights in human or natural rights. So the United States expresses quite clearly that, and this comes from the International Convention on Civil and Political Rights, where a person not expressing international law is receiving no consideration of those laws. The only way for to receive consideration of those laws is to clearly express them. So we're having issues with that, because not only is the police department a form of lower government on a county municipal level, coming from a corporate law perspective, they do not consider or have any obligation to express or to teach you or to educate you about your international rights. Right. The only thing that they must do is to cover all of the discrimination prohibitions, things that are prohibited as far as discrimination is concerned. But do they need to tell you why? Do they need to tell you where those laws come from? Anything to that effect? The answer is no. It's on you as a member of the public to know how to express international rights by expressing the fact that you have a national origin. Many people have no clue what a national origin is, and that's including people who are currently working for the government. To express that you are of age and that you are competent. A lot of people know age discrimination to only be referring to your age as far as, you know, are you old and you're not eligible? You can't get a job because you're too old to work. They think of age discrimination strictly in those from that context. But in reality, age discrimination is more relevant to everybody when it comes to competency. Okay, because in many situations, rights are removed from people who are deemed to be not competent. So if you have a minor who is not competent, they have the same level of rights as an adult who is not competent.
Right, because okay. One case was a 17-year-old young man. Mm-hmm. So he officially would fall into that. Because I was going to ask you that, like, what other civil rights were violated? And I was specifically thinking about the case of the 17-year-old man who, or young man, excuse me, this is crazy because he, according to the Department of Government Justice website, the young man, real briefly, he made his mom mad. And so Victor Hill had a deputy go pick him up, brought him back to the jail, put him in restraint chairs. And I'm like, well, did he get consent from his mom to do that? First of all. Second of all, I was 16 when I went to Marine Corps, but my mom had to sign for me. At 17, what rights did he have to prevent him from going through that experience?
It's very rare that any law. One thing, if you have any experience with administrative enforcement, when you call to ask questions in a lot of places, they'll tell you, we can't give you any legal advice. We can't give you legal advice. They just let you sign away. And, you know, they'll give you the contract and they'll put all the terms of the contract in there. But then they'll tell you, we can't give you no advice. OK, so when a person does not express their rights or they don't know where to even start, those rights are not considered. The only thing that is considered is the law governing that transaction or that agreement. So in most situations, whenever we sign off on something, no matter how what the age is, competency is something that in our competency is only recognized in areas where corporations want to recognize it. And so I'll give you an example of a situation that kind of, demonstrates that. At a bank, I think you and I may have discussed this once or twice before. At a bank, you go into a bank and they'll give you a bunch of disclosures and tell you to sign all these documents so that you can open up your account. But then when it's time for you to go and access credit, they will not allow you to make any signatures or do any bilateral negotiations between you and the bank. It's always unilateral, boilerplate type of leave it adhesion contracts. There's never an ability to negotiate the terms. And the reason for that is because the banks confer their powers from their corporate policies. Okay, and so in a lot of situations, banks are operating a lot like the United States, where the only governing laws are the laws of the corporation. I think I showed you before in our chart that the executive department is completely separate from the legislative and judicial branches. So when we're discussing where are these laws coming from, who does it apply to, where do we find the powers, the authority, it's all corporate law. It's all corporate.
So you're saying the true authority mm-hmm. of a local jurisdiction is merely corporate law.
It's corporate law. It's coming from corporate contracts. It's coming from. So one thing we have to understand about our constitutions, declaration, bills, acts, those are contracts.
Right.
Those are agreements to serve the public. Those are agreements within one entity to serve public trust or to serve the public under public trust. So when we have that type of structure, what it allows our government to do and these local authorities is for them to act in a quasi or dual capacity. And so they will derive their powers from their corporate authority, and then they will present themselves as a judicial function because they have a congressional body that is set up to perform these duties and acts. But this is all still coming from the corporate authority of the Constitution. It's not necessarily a judicial.
So the corporate authority is vested within the Constitution. So,
yes.
So
the Constitution.
I'm sorry, you broke up. Say that one more time.
It all derives from the Constitution, which is a corporate type of agreement.
Got you.
And it's there for commerce. It's there to not have anything to do with our nationality or anything to do with our natural rights. It's there to specifically create rules statutes, you know, just governing provisions for commercial activity. It doesn't have anything to anything else.
So then what's the significant impact on our daily existence then? I mean, government, corporation, most people look at government and corporation as two separate entities, with the government being the higher power over the corporation, right? Yet governments regulating corporations. Yet what you're saying is based upon not interpretation, or I shouldn't say interpretation, but not, but based upon, not based upon opinion, but based upon fact, based upon the documentation, is that it's not a situation where we have government and corporation. Yet instead, what we have is corporation and corporation. We have corporation regulating corporation.
Correct. And the reason why that is significant to us is because corporations are contracts in order for them to derive power. So there
because unfortunately, we're having an issue with the audio, and a word that you said broke off. And I want to make sure the listeners hear that. I apologize.
No problem.
Say that again, please.
So I was just saying that the reason why it's significant to our everyday life, what's happening there, is because governments are, in the corporate function, they require contracts like any other corporation. When a corporation is doing business, when they're completing transactions, when they are asserting themselves some form of authority, that requires a contract.
And so you say like a driver's license is a contract?
Well, it can be. Now, there are some...
So then but if it can be, is it? It can be, or is it? Because... Because you have to ask for the, you have to apply for the permission to drive on the roads within that jurisdiction, or within, I guess you could say, to make it easier, corporate grounds. Could you say, like, would that be synonymous, corporate grounds jurisdiction? Oh, yeah. So you're applying for permission to be able to drive your little cart or your car on corporate grounds, and then they have, within that application for permission, they have the stipulations of what it would take for approval of driving on those corporate grounds. And then you have to affix your signature to that application. So how is that not a contract?
It is a contract in certain sense. But when we talk about a contract, firstly, there are elements to contracts that make them valid and make them invalid. So, and then there are also provisions in contracts or stipulations that will make that contract an expressed contract, an implied contract. And so when these things happen, it changes the dynamic of the validity and the enforcement capacity, or the enforceability of the contract itself. So in a sense where a driver's license is in question, we have implied contracts that are not, when it comes to a driver's license. So when a police officer pulls you over and they're telling that you're required to come into court, that you must appear for your criminal charges and all these things, that's an implied contract. And it becomes invalid when there are elements violated. For example, if you don't have any victims, there's no damage being done, but they will say that it's a crime. That's unconstitutional. To require a person to appear in a court in person, in most situations, local authorities will tell you that you have to come in to appear in their court and file an answer. They never disclose to you that filing an answer automatically implies your submission to their jurisdiction. They will not tell you that. But in contract law, it absolutely does, because it's essentially, it's like the example I gave you the other day, where if you and I are walking down the street, we don't know each other from a can of paint, and I stop you and I say, how much money you got in your pocket? You will look at me and say, who are you? I don't recognize your authority to ask me that. We don't have any agreements. I don't owe you any money. There's no relationship between you and I. So why would I answer you? You see? Right. Because if you ask me that and I answer, It means I recognize your right to even ask.
You know, what's amazing about what you're talking about right now in this particular moment, we were speaking earlier about the individual Othol Wallace that's on trial right now for a crime in which he allegedly committed. Anybody can look that up. But the case is hinging on that one particular fact right there. Mm-hmm. Who gave the authority, or not even who gave the authority? What, like, I'm trying to pose this question because basically it's like the way to put the officer approached Mr. Wallace. Mr. Wallace was sitting in his car. The officer came from the outside, walked up. So Mr. Wallace was like, well, who are you that you can question me?
Right.
And in the midst of that, the officer put his hands on him. And so the situation escalated further. And it goes back to exactly what you're talking about right now. You know, and I remember, unfortunately, I have a misdemeanor. I'm gonna state this publicly. I have a misdemeanor on my record. Mm-hmm. For failure to dim my headlights in the state of Georgia. If you live in the state of Georgia, you understand that that's a misdemeanor, and that's crazy. Mm-hmm. So my lawyer told me, she said, we as citizens are most vulnerable when we're in our vehicles and we're driving along the roadways and access ways. At the time, I didn't understand it yet. Mm-hmm. Talking about what you're talking about and then looking at what's going on with Mr. Wallace right now, super vulnerable, because it's like, if I'm not committing a crime or minding my business, who are you to accost me, mm-hmm. you know, question me? Like, we live in a country where we have the right to exist peacefully mm-hmm. without being harassed, whatever the case may be. So what you know, and so it begs the question, how? How do people get this information and get this knowledge so that they don't be vulnerable? So that they don't find themselves in a situation like Mr. Wallace is currently finding himself in. Mm-hmm. With that ability to protect yourself, that ability to exercise your sovereignty.
I'm going to show you a definition real quick. This is something. Yeah. And I
the corporate critic, of course.
Right, yes. You know, we came here to do the work. So I'm actually going to see if I can maybe blow this up a little bit. You can see that, right?
I can see that you are showing me a document from what's the source?
All right. So let me scroll up real quick. This comes from the state tort claims policy here in Georgia. So what we're looking at is the provisions that allow us to bring suit against the state for is coming from people, like I was saying earlier, who are acting in a government capacity or to serve the public in a public office under public trust. They have an insurance fund where you can actually go and claim your damages from the insurance that pays out instead of you trying from the actual individual that took action to cause harm to you or mm-hmm. did not take the proper action and it caused harm. So with this insurance policy, essentially, this is what is laying out the provisions of how you make those claims as a tort. Okay, so what I want to note of is these definitions. Okay, we have definitions. These are words used in the policy unless the context of the word demands another, it says another definition. So what we're looking at is extremely important where it talks about what is a state, okay? Where we look, right here, we're gonna, so let's see if I can highlight this. Is it gonna let me highlight it? Nope. But it's okay. So it says state means the state of Georgia and any of its offices, agencies, authorities, departments, commissions, boards, divisions, instrumentalities, and institutions, but does not include counties, municipalities, school districts, or other of local government, hospitals, authorities, or housing and other local authorities. That lets you know right there that is not a part of the state. They are not insured. They are not sovereign. They are corporations like Walmart and Target, like anyone else. And when you try to sue them for your damages, the state is not going to cover it. They're going to tell you that you need to go to that local authority that you're talking about and handle it with them. Mm-hmm. And so this is highly, it's highly relevant to talking about, because there is a overall perception that needs to change. We need to have a paradigm shift when we're talking about public and private, because it will tell you that you have to consider this before you can even bring a claim. If you have not first set out who you're talking about, and I'm going to show you this. There's another, Georgia State Organizations. Let's go look at what Georgia State Organizations look like on the Georgia.gov website. So this list is a full list of the state government. So if you're going to do a tort claim against anybody, you're going to have to get their name off this list or else they're not covered. Okay, so over here, and this is with any state. Okay, it has to be a part of the state government, state organizations. These are all of the, you see, you have the Supreme Court of Georgia, the Superior Courts of Georgia. So out of all of the courts in Georgia, this is a structural observation to be had when we're talking about government. Of all the courts in Georgia, there is one government agency that governs them all. And that's going to be the Superior Courts of Georgia organization. When we click here, it says the Superior Courts of Georgia is a court of general jurisdiction having both civil and criminal actions. Superior Courts preside over cases involving misdemeanors, so on and so forth. So when we go and look and see what this one organization, you see where it starts taking us into all of the local courts, because this is just one organization that we're talking about.
Right.
But now they're going to tell you that you need to go and find which one is closest to you. What we have to observe here is that the one that's closest to you is a privately contracted company.
Okay, so.
See what I mean?
Yep. So in the case of Victor Hill, he was criminally prosecuted, found guilty of civil rights violations, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So on the civil side, who... this list would the victims who how would they sue Victor Hill, or would they sue him as an individual?
They would need to sue him as an individual if they wanted to recover the damages. Now, to hold him liable, they can go to one of these state organizations and hope that that state organization will actually enforce. So you can see that you have all of these different types of enforcement apps you can take.
You wouldn't be able to add into that suit who he's working for or whose authority he's acting under?
Well, you can, like I said, you can go to them and let them know that he's out of line. You can go to any one of the regulators, and you can have them to take your complaint. You can have them to listen to your griefs and your gripes. But when it comes down to liability, what we're talking about here is liability. Think about this, what we were just looking at on this screen. The liability is what we're talking about. Where you see where it says limits of liability? Okay. The limitation on the fund's liability shall be as stated on the declarations page. So maybe we can go to the limit the declarations page. Let's see. Because all insurance agreements have a declarations page. So It says that, look, first we're going to name the people who are insured, okay? All of the state of Georgia government entities, which includes state offices, agencies, authorities, departments, commissions, board, like we just read. The Department of Administrative Services may provide endorsements for liability. So this is what they're talking about when I say that government functions are contracted out to private entities, like procurement, okay? So they may allow endorsements for contractual liability depending on the contract. Then it says the Department of Administrative Services may, where necessary, to the public, to the public purposes of the state entity, provide for additional insureds. But essentially, this list of people here, these are the ones who are insured. That's it.
Right.
If you don't work in this building for this company or for this particular agency, you may or may not see that coverage. So when we go here and we look at, you see the conditions of coverage. You see you have to give a notice of the suit that you want to file. It gives you all of the provisions. It tells you what's immune, okay, what they're not going to do. Settlements goes through the whole thing. Okay, and so I wonder, is this a declarations page? No, that's an endorsement. I don't see the declarations page. But we'll probably be able to find that somewhere else. But when they talk about liability, okay, the liability is always going to be pretty much limited to those entities that are named as the insured and those organizations, you know, the employees of those organizations, they'll be covered by this type of coverage. So let's read it. It says, provided, however, where losses are incurred as a combination of bodily injury, property damage, or personal injury to one person, all such damages shall be combined in the calculating the total liability per person, which shall not exceed the per person liability limit of $1 million. If it was multiple persons, they go up to $3 million. Okay, so it goes into telling you where you can find other provisions. It says, in any action or claim for damage under the provisions of the Georgia Tort Claims Act, pursuant to Article 8 of Chapter 8 of Title 31, any caps specified under this code section, notwithstanding any applicability limitations specified in such code sections. So what they're telling you is this is the amount that they cannot exceed per claim, but you can actually have more than one claim, if I'm not mistaken. So it makes a difference for us to go in here and actually look and see what type of coverage these people have depending on where they work. Most of the people that we deal with on an everyday basis, they're not a part of the state government. They're not government employees. They're just government contractors.
So be specific. When you say most people that we deal with on a daily, what people? Police? Mm-hmm. What people are you talking about specifically?
So right here where it tells us that what's not included, where it says counties, so any of your county police, the county courthouses, the counties, you know, their registrar or the people, you know, counties. Anybody in the county that's not a part, that's a contractor. They're not covered as a state government agency or a state government entity, okay, or as a part of the state. Mm-hmm. Now is that, again,
okay.
You see where the next thing it says, that what is a state government entity? A state office, agency, authority.
I see part four, conditions of coverage, notice of claim. And then above that, I see the definitions.
Mm-hmm. What I'm looking
state
at.
State officer, employee,
number 8 and number 7. Number eight. Yeah.
State government entity, state officer, employee.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
You see how it makes a differentiation, because it says it does not include counties, municipalities, school districts, and all of that.
Right.
So these are the people that we typically are dealing with. We very rarely touch a state agency or office. Very rarely. What happens is
so state police pull you over. It's significant regarding the driver's license issue. We're going back to that, which is, again, mm-hmm. we're trying to keep it tied to Victor Hill, because Victor Hill wasn't state police. Well, let's throw the driver's license out. Victor Hill is not state police. Victor Hill was the county sheriff. So So the individuals involved whose rights were violated, because Victor Hill was not a state employee, they had no right to sue or to pursue action against him, or rather against the state. So they could sue him as an individual or take action against him and the individual, as well as the contracting party, because the contracting party hired him. He wasn't even an independent contractor.
Mm-hmm. And it's why it's really important for us to understand the structure of the government, because we can create liability by exposing the lack of competency of the contractors. So if, let's just say, I go to the police multiple times and I tell them, you're ticketing me and giving me citations that are not valid.
And not state police. We gotta be very specific. So if you're going to non-state police, even
any of them.
Okay.
Because all the entire United States corporate structure is a corporate structure.
Right.
It is a corporate structure. Some judicial elements to it, but those judicial elements are not what is coming into consideration when we're dealing with these contracts or the lack thereof. Okay, so the judicial functions, they are valid in the sense that if you submit that to that using your agreement or implied or expressed, then it does apply. But in situations where you have not given that type of consideration, then the United States it needs to recognize that you have not submitted yourself into their commercial jurisdiction, because the United States is purely commercial jurisdiction. Anything they do needs to be by express consent, informed consent. It needs to be by contract, by agreement. It does not, there is no right of any government to assert itself over an individual who does not subscribe to or pledge allegiance to an authority, because international law gives us the right to self-determine our political status. Okay, and this is the reason why we have that
international covenant. I'm sorry, say that last part again.
I said that's the reason why we have that international covenant.
So you're saying the premise for Victor Hill to be convicted was the fact that through it all, he had no right whatsoever to detain these individuals nor put them through the situations that he put them through. He had no right. He was given no right based upon the contracts that's already been established by the corporation.
Well, yes, the exception to that rule is if there is damage. If there is damage done, if there is a victim, then the jurisdiction would apply if you have caused some sort of harm, and you would not be able to assert your own self-governing jurisdictions to get out of that. But if you have not created any victim, if you have not created any real damage to any real property, to any real person, natural being, then everything you're doing as far as, you know, going into the court, using the police service, these are public services. And so with any service, you need to consent. You need to agree. You need to negotiate. It's the same with any other contract in commerce. These corporate parties, they are deriving an authority that is higher, or they're conferring an authority that is higher than one that the law allows them without an expressed agreement. And so, like, for example, you know how if you have, let's just say somebody kicked and they dented your car because they were, you know, trying to skateboard and lost control. So you say, well, you know, I need to sue this person because they're not willing to willingly give up the money for the damage they did to my car. That's real damage. You're a real victim because you're going to have to come out of pocket and pay for that if you get it repaired. For you to be set whole, you're going to take your claim to a court, and it's worth money. It's the reason why it's a service, because they're going to charge you money to file into their court to use their adjudication services. So they're going to say, well, we're going to let us know who the was, give us their name, information. We're going to provide a service. We will serve notice on them. We will compel them to come to court. We will compel them to file an answer, and we will use our court declarations and our court contracts and all of these setups that we have to compel these people to submit themselves to our jurisdiction. Now, in that situation, the person could say, well, I don't recognize your authority, so I'm going to suggest another venue for this service to take place. Because, like, for example, maybe you don't have subject matter authority over this particular claim, because I have a counterclaim that supersedes your dollar threshold. So that service there would not be applicable. The court would have to bound it over to another court to provide the service, because their limitations are set as far as what they can actually hear in their court. So some courts, I saw this once in a child support claim where a court issued an order after they had a man sign over a waiver of his rights to service, like honest service, and to submit himself or to submit himself to the jurisdiction of that court. Okay, so it's important for us to remember that these are agreements that need to be had. There are certain levels where the court cannot just assert itself if it doesn't have that capacity. So we have to remember how to maneuver and how to establish that court's capacity by remembering the structure of law itself and how the administration of law happened in that particular circumstance. But in our everyday lives, you know, in our everyday lives, it takes on the form of, oh, well, the court said I have to do it, so I have to do it. And that's just not simply true. We have rights. If you look at the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, it'll take your maybe eighth grade civics class, or where it talks about you being a citizen is about you pledging an allegiance. That happens voluntarily, right? Where you pledge allegiance to the flag for which it stands and you go through all of this stuff. That's a voluntary act. You can easily sit down and not pledge allegiance to this order. You can easily say, I don't recognize
easily. You can't easily. We can look up news articles where kids are getting kicked out of school and things of that nature for not pledging allegiance to the flag.
Well, you know, that would be something that they could, and you're right, it might not be easy, but it is something that they could argue. And I'm going to, now let's look at it. We're going to look at this this language
you said,
here.
You said, I'm sorry, go ahead. Mm-hmm. No, you said that that's something that they could argue in a tort situation.
Mm-hmm. They could argue this in many situations. Civil, if there's a certain intent there, it could be criminal. There could be quite a few implications that come from this. So what I want to point out here is this is a manual, as you can see, an online training course. A program of instruction from policy. It's about like Georgia Post training. It's in the seal, it says Georgia Public Safety Training Center. So this is where police officers go to get their training and what they are, kind of given about what their role to society actually is. So a peace officer and a police officer are one and the same. They're used interchangeably. For some reason, we call them police and not peace officers. I don't know why, but I think it has something to do with perception when we call them police instead of peace officers. So the reason why perception is extremely important is because it lends the text to how we perceive police legitimacy. So in this online training course, we go to some definitions. Definitions are highly important. So what we're going to do is break down this definition here where it says legitimate versus legitimacy at the very bottom. Okay, so if you do me, just read out this definition in letter A.
Of section 2, legitimate versus legitimacy?
Yes, I just want you to read the first one.
Legitimate, allowed according to rules or laws, real, accepted, official, fair, or reasonable.
Okay, so that's a general good definition of what legitimate. If something is legitimate, that means it's allowed according to rules, laws. You know, if the laws are real, okay. If it's accepted, if it's official, fair, or reasonable, that's a good definition of what something is legitimate. Okay, so now I'm going to read B, legitimacy. Now you see, we're making before I even go further, we're making a difference. It's a differentiation here between legitimate and police legitimacy.
Right.
And you can see that in part two, where it says two legitimate versus legitimacy, it don't say nothing about police. But then when you get down to the definition, they add the word police in there. So there's a distinct point that's being made. So right. Police legitimacy, it says the idea or belief. You see, in the former definition, it said real, accepted, real and accepted.
Right, right.
Allowed, okay?
Right.
Police legitimacy, it says it's just the idea, the belief that the police have the authority or the right to dictate proper behavior and enforce the law. This right. is in their training.
Right.
So it tells us that if I don't have the idea and I don't have the belief that the police have the authority or the right to dictate proper behavior and law, what does that mean?
Yeah, what this? Does it mean? Yeah, that's
it means it's not legitimate.
Mm-hmm.
It means if I, because we're looking at commutative properties, this is universal law, this is syntax, language. This is, we're breaking down the definite, every word in these sentences has a meaning, has a definition. It has an impact, an effect on understanding. Okay. So when right. it says police legitimacy, if something is legitimate, that means it is allowed. That means in the affirmative, if it is legitimate, it is allowed according to rules, laws. And we're talking about universal laws, not just laws written down by John Henry III or whoever else. Okay. We're talking right. about real laws because it says real. Universal laws are real laws. All right. And then it's laws that are accepted according to rules or laws accepted, official, fair, or reasonable. Is it reasonable for me to have the idea or the belief that the laws and rules and you know, statutes and regulations of a foreign occupier, a foreign settler on my land, would it be reasonable or fair for me to have the belief that that's legitimate to me?
Well, but you see, here's the thing. It's, again, we're talking about syntax.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about meaning, okay? We're talking about a legal document that could be utilized in a court of law to prove legitimacy or illegitimacy. And my disposition, I mean, now more than ever, is there's universal law and then there's Bill, Fred, Ted, them people law, right? And forgive me for the pause, because you know, you say you're providing a lot of information, and the information, the question that resonates and screams in my head, and I would imagine others as well, is how does this apply to what I have to deal with every day in real time, and especially in all encounters, whether I'm paying my light bill, because what you're saying in a nutshell is that all of these jurisdictions, the police, I may mention of the light bills, so the utilities, all of these are implied. We don't have to abide by none of these rules according to the rules of the state.
So only in commerce. Now, let's just say.
Only in commerce. Mm-hmm. Only in commerce.
Only in commerce. In commerce. So when it comes to the police.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm not differentiating that. I'm not saying I can be a criminal and do whatever I want to do. What I am saying is that in exercising my rights as a citizen every day, my constitutional right, which one is the constitutional right? Now, I guess I should know this, but I know too much stuff. And I could look it up. That gives me a right to peace and happiness. Is it an amendment or is it in the preamble to the Constitution? You understand what I'm saying? Like, I have a right as stated by the Constitution to the pursuit of happiness, to the pursuit of freedom, to the pursuit of liberty. So in the midst of that, how all of these other implied jurisdictions. How do I fight against that and live to tell about it and not get kicked out of my house and not get foreclosed on? Is the sheriff going to come for that? Not get the electricity cut off. You know what I'm saying? Like, we're still paying these people. We're still listening to them when they say, show us your identification, things that they, we're still doing what they tell us to do, whether we sign in our signature or not. So it's like, how, with all this information, how do you take this information and apply it to what I got to do every day in my existence? Or is that too general?
You have to understand what it means to operate in commerce and not outside of commerce. So there
are... Say that one more time. You got it. Say that one more time. Say that one more time. You have to what now?
Understand how to operate in commerce. If we are operating from a perspective where we don't know how to exercise our right, then we end up not having the ability to use commerce as a product, because commerce is a product. So it might sound convoluted, but at the end of the day, why is this not coming up the way I want it to come up? Let me go here for a second so I can find this before I pull it up. The reason why it's important to understand how commerce actually works is because we are being held as what they call a surety for the government's obligations to operate commerce in our benefit under trust. So
define what that is. Define what a surety is.
A surety is when you are doing something on behalf of someone who has an obligation to do it.
Okay. So we're acting on behalf of someone that has an obligation to do something for us. Because you just said that we're acting as surety.
That's
so
correct.
So we're acting on the behalf of somebody that's supposed to be doing something for us.
Correct.
So I'm acting on behalf, when I'm talking about the lights, the electric, the internet being on.
That's a government obligation.
Say that, I'm sorry, go ahead.
That is called a government obligation. Now, this goes back to the laws that came into consideration with our tribal governments. The United States developed a trust relationship with us to handle all of that stuff. Now, instead of them handling it, they pass off the liability to us to manage the resources, to distribute the resources, to manage human resources, especially to preserve our natural resources.
Define the they and the us, though. So you're saying they, the authorities of the state or the authorities of the corporation, has given us, the citizens, the responsibility, so forth and so forth?
No.
I'm confused.
We have a trust relationship with the United States, tribal governments, indigenous people. This is our land. It's our land. It always has been. The government recognizes that, which is the reason why there is a trust relationship between us and them. So us and them is indigenous people who are native to this land, who have never migrated here, who have been here since humans have been on this landmass.
Okay.
It's our land. So for them to settle on our land, they needed to enshrine themselves, so to speak, embed themselves into our history. The way they did that was they started beating us. They started committing violent acts against us. And then sold us protection from the violence that we were suffering at their hands.
Then what? Say that again.
Sold it to us. They sold us.
Sold it.
As a product. Commerce is a product. Money is a product.
The credit system that we're on, it is a product. So what they said was, we will give you protection. We will manage your land. We'll manage your resources. We're going to be your trustees. Your land is now under our control because we are your trustees. We're going to protect you. This is the reason we say the government is there to protect you. Protect and serve. Mm-hmm. It's a product. We're paying taxes to purchase that product. They sold it to us under the guise of it being a government, something that we introduced to them. However, what actually happened was they conferred their power of sovereignty, saying that because you need us to manage your land, because you need us to protect you from violence and all this other stuff, you are now dependent on us. And we are sovereign. You are domestic. In all reality, we are foreign. We have no common bonds, no affiliations, no genetic ties whatsoever to the people
that live themselves. You just saying, in all reality, we are foreign.
Correct.
But previous to that, we're indigenous. So what do you mean specifically justify that?
Indigenous and foreign are synonymous terms.
Say again. Indigenous and foreign are synonymous
terms.
Got you. And that, how are they synonymous for one another? Because by definition, indigenous.
They are synonymous. We are indigenous. They came here to settle. So obviously we are foreign. We cannot be domestic. We don't have any relationship to Caucasian people or British people who came here to settle on our land. So we are foreign because we are indigenous. So there is no relationship there. There's no relationship. There's no relationship. Shahid, hush. I'm talking. So there's no relationship there. And that's what foreign, because we are indigenous, they are foreign.
Yeah, but no, I don't know if it's the audio, but it sounded like you said, because we are indigenous, we are foreign.
They are foreign.
That's what I'm saying.
Think about it. Are you related to Caucasian people?
No. This is what I'm telling you. When you play this back, listen to it and hear it. Does it sound like you're saying they or we? That's why I asked you that question specifically. That's why I said justify that. The audio that I'm hearing coming back from my speakers sound like you said we are indigenous, then you said some words and you said we are foreign. Now I asked you, how can we be indigenous and foreign at the same time? But you're not saying that we are foreign. You're saying we are indigenous and they are foreign, correct?
That is the same thing.
What is the same thing? They both are foreign.
The fact, listen.
I'm listening.
The fact that we are indigenous to this land and they are not. We agree right there, right? That means that those people are foreign to our people.
Mm-hmm. Not we are foreign to them or we are foreign to them.
That is the same thing. If they are foreign to us, we are foreign to them.
I got you.
That's what it is. They're not indigenous to this land. We are. That means we are foreign to them.
We got it.
So this is the reason why, if you are talking about the application of law, the laws of a foreign people don't have. We don't follow the laws of India in America because they're foreign. They follow Indian laws in India. So if a British person comes up and tries to tell me that I'm under domestic to their laws, how? Where? It makes no sense. But in America, that's how we run every single day. Every single day. We subject ourselves to the rules and of regulations of a foreign nation. They brought their policies and regulations and stipulations, their commerce over here. Why? Because we don't have we allowed them to take our systems of government and claim them for themselves. And now they're saying, because I'm protecting you, I am in control of you. You are subject to my foreign laws. We have not rebutted that at all.
So they're saying, because I am protecting you from me.
Right. Because
I'm protecting you from me, then you're subjugated to my will, because I'm protecting you from me.
That's it. That is essentially what has happened. And when you get that, I've shared with you the American Indian law in a nutshell, it will break that down to you completely. It will break it down to you completely how we got here to that conclusion.
And forgive me, because I'm in this day and age, I work vehemently, if you will, inside to choose my words wisely. We utilize the English language.
I respect that.
As indigenous people, we do the history. Our lands being stolen versus our lands being lost in war.
That's a very complex answer to that. But essentially...
Right. It's very... Everything went black for a second. I was like, I know I didn't use electric. Okay, we back. It's a very complicated issue.
Right. Yes, it gets
complex. I have it right here. So I'm going through it and I'm studying it to show thyself approved.
Good.
And what we're talking about in a nutshell, no pun intended.
Right.
Right. Is again the ability to exercise our rights peacefully in a dignified manner. So the case of Victor Hill and those four individuals that were represented in the case against him. They are indigenous being subjugated to a foreign power. And the only way that they can exercise their rights is the ability to know exactly on the spot, and then the ability to enforce what they know on the spot to be able to mitigate what occurred to them. Right? That's what we're saying in the next show.
Yes, you have to know your rights to be able to enforce them, if that's what you mean. Yes, you have to be able to say it. Correct. Yeah. Yes, they're not going to enforce it. That's never going to happen. So I'm going to have to go in a second here, because I've just got to, I'm going to wrap up. I got a lot of stuff going on. But what I will do is we're going to come back next week. Like I said, we're going to continue the discussion about how these corporate laws are impacting our structure and our ability to self-govern our own territories, and what we can actually do as a nation of people who are foreign to our occupiers, the people who have come to occupy our land. And so we're going to continue that conversation. So it's been a pleasure. I'm going to go ahead and, we'll go ahead and post this to the podcast, and we'll come back next week with another either follow-up topic, or we'll talk about something else that we can kind of make clear. Okay.
Sure.
Okay. All right. Well, I'll talk to you soon. It's been a pleasure.
Indeed. All right. Thank you.
Peace.
Peace.